Welcome to University Drive, your pathway to the transformational work of University of the Bahamas. Our goal is to build a better Bahamas by shaping tomorrow's leaders today, finding solutions to challenges, and forging new opportunities for growth. University Drive, where faculty, staff, students, and alumni travel the road of progress together with you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to University Drive. I'm your host, Tamika Lundy. Thank you very much for joining us for this episode of Season 8 of University Drive. The world is facing one of the biggest challenges to its existence that it has ever faced. Many world leaders have been in a huddle, some making commitments, others pleading for even more action. On some fronts, there's silence. Climate change, however, will not be ignored. It's here, and we are feeling the destructive effects. Hurricane Dorian was proof. And 2 years later, the Bahamas is still sifting through lessons and experiences for adaptation and mitigation strategies. Joining us today as our guest is Associate Professor of English and Adjunct Faculty in the School of Social Sciences at University of the Bahamas, Dr. Ian Bethel Bennett, a researcher. Hello, Dr. Bethel Bennett. Welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Hello, Ms. Lundy. Thank you so much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Happy to have you here. You have had your research published in the International Journal of Bahamian Studies, the 27th volume that came out recently. And your study is entitled Dorian, Unmaking Space, Policy, Place and Dislocation. It focuses on the impacts of Hurricane Dorian on Abaco and the fallout, and it's specifically delving into what you refer to as spatial and climate injustice, structural and slow violence, and disaster capitalism. That is a whole mouthful. What does that all mean, and why this particular research focus?
That's a good question. Why this? I'm going to start with the last question first. Why this focus? One of the reasons I looked at this was because it's happening everywhere. So we have from Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans in 2005 to Hurricane Dorian. And one of the things that we're seeing is that big businesses, hedge funds, are coming in and commodifying the commons, or what used to be commons, and basically making life too expensive for people, traditional occupants, to rebuild more resiliently or otherwise, and to continue to live in their communities. So the communities have died, been remapped, and the rezoning has continued. So schools have closed. Hospitals and clinics that would serve low-income populations have been dispersed, and the service provision within the space has disappeared. We see this in Puerto Rico, and a lot of my colleagues in Puerto Rico were publishing on this, especially after Maria, because of the impact of the financial downturn. So what I noticed was that there was not a whole lot of discussion around climate change or spatial injustice in the Bahamas. And I was hoping that this paper might just begin that kind of conversation, given that we see it around us and we see it in many different ways, from Maria in Puerto Rico to Irma in Barbuda, and then Maria in Barbuda, and then the way that Irma was dealt with on Ragged Island, and Joaquin before that, and Long Island, and the Southern Bahamas.
Got it. So I want to get some clarity on these terms now, because we're going to be talking about these as we move along in our discussion. What do we mean when we say structural and slow violence?
Structural violence is actually the violence used by the structures. So the state, the governance, the laws, the economics of the state and the colonial apparatus or apparatus that was in place prior to independence. And that is the violence that excludes voices. And the slow violence is that there are inhabitants who dwell in particular spaces, and those spaces may be really uninhabitable, but because they have dwelt there for so many years, they don't feel the violence of constant floodings or contamination, pollution that comes up in their homes. We have areas in New Providence that are flood prone, and they are flood prone because they were made to be flood prone through processes that had occurred prior to them being set up as communities. But there is no discussion about that because it is these areas are seen as working class or working poor communities and therefore not really of merit. So one example of that, again, with the slow violence, is looking at the mud in terms of a space where stateless people or undocumented migrants are allowed to live, in fact, encouraged to live, and are therefore vulnerable to the kind of violence that being in an uninhabitable space brings when it rains, when there's a hurricane, when there's a fire. So there are justifications for the violence that they encounter. I hope that makes sense.
That explains it a whole lot. And spatial injustice, what do you mean? What do we mean when we refer to that?
So I am stepping back into geography as a study, as a discipline, in terms of much more Marxist geography in the way that space is constructed and understood. And one, if we look at Edward Said, who was the Palestinian academic and activist, an incredible academic, thought about in Palestine, where the colonial powers actually annex Palestine, unmap it and remap it, making Palestinian space contingent to Israeli existence. So the Palestine city, state, country no longer exists except as an annexed part of Israel. So the whole space has been remapped. And that is looking at the way that colonial or the first settlers who violently dispossessed the people who originally lived there, came in and took the land. And that act of violence continues through the spatial injustice. So we look at spatial justice where everybody is equitably served by the natural resources, by their ability to live in the space that they inhabit. And then we understand that injustice is when acts from beyond them control the way they can access services or resources. So schools within a particular area will be less than stellar because it is that particular area.
Okay, good. So we're laying the foundation, I understand. We're laying the foundation for the conversation we will continue to have. We're just demystifying some of these terms. Okay, so what I found interesting also about your research is that you took what's called an autoethnographic approach. What is that? Explain for our listeners, and why this kind of approach to your study entitled Dorian and Making Space, Policy, Place, and Dislocation?
Again, because so many experiences that we have on a daily basis are violently erased by either the state or state apparatus or others who see our voices as unimportant. And so what the anthropologist or the ethnographer would do is come in, collect data, and take that data or those pieces of data and use it to put together a narrative. And that narrative tends to have far more weight or hold far more weight than the version that comes out of the people who dwell within that space. So because of my experiences with anthropology and ethnography and my insider-outsider view of being in Abaco, I put myself in the situation of being the insider who could critique what was going on with an insider's gaze or lens, and that way being a part of the action, but also trying to look from the outside and see what was not being seen, if that makes sense. So it's collecting the data, the stories, the tales, the experiences, and highlighting those over validating them or invalidating them.
So as I read through your research, one of the first things that stood out to me was where you indicated that in Abaco, and you were on the ground in Abaco 1 week after Hurricane Dorian, you said there was no disaster or evacuation policy or plan in place for something that was that devastating. And if there was a policy, no one could point to it. Right. No one knew of it. No one knew how to use it. And the word policy, right? Yeah. In the title of your research, is in relation to the dire need to create national plans, guidelines that are both robust and widely available for the public. I find that to be profound. Can you explain that a little bit?
If we don't have policies that the public are aware of, or if we have policies that the public are not aware of, then we don't have policies. Because the only way policy can work is if people know that there is a policy. One of the ways you can get rid of people's rights is by not understanding that they have those rights. And so you disempower them and you basically marginalize them. So the challenge with policy is that it should not only be well thought out, but it has to be living. It has to be in the community, and the community has to be aware of it. But also the people who are to implement the policy have to understand that there is a policy and that the policy has these steps, and these steps will result in certain consequences. If that is not the case, then there is no policy that we can refer to. And unfortunately, that has continued to be true for a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what you found when you went to Abaco that week later. And you wrote that what you observed, and actually what followed Dorian and much later after it left, what you found was depressing and sobering. And I just want to tell our listeners that the reason why we're going back to what you found is because in order for us to plan for ways in which we can adapt and mitigate and kind of be prepared for disasters or situations that might resemble Dorian, we have to understand where the gaps are and actively plan for how to bridge those gaps, right? So you called it depressing and sobering. And I found that to be interesting because you're talking a bit about the silencing of voices and people's experiences and accounts, personal experiences versus the official quote unquote reports from the government and other officials and other sources versus people's own experiences. So expound on that a little bit.
So if everyone remembers that when Dorian hit, it was pretty much, it became chaotic very quickly. And we were in that whole chaos because, of course, our families are there and our, you know, there's property and friends and all of that. So you're in the chaos and you hear what's going on as long as there is WhatsApp and as long as there was a mobile service. When that ended, there was a deep void until it picked up again. So the void is actually far more violent than the space of sound, because you don't know what's going on. You know what has gone on, and people are saying to you, oh, we're going to lose the house. Oh, we're going to have this experience. And then you come into the space after most people were rescued or paid to be taken out, because they had to pay to be taken out. And you have these documented narratives of people's firsthand experiences. And those have been denied multiple times by officials. And you come into the space and you see exactly the lay of the land that has been described in those narratives. And so the physical evidence is overwhelmingly refutes the authoritarian narrative of smooth sailing and everything is okay. And just moving through the spaces and noticing the different reactions of the people who were taking us around. So we were escorted by officers. And once we got to a particular part of the settlement, we became aware that people suddenly started taking their guns. And because of the narratives that had been shared with us prior to that, we understood what was happening. But of course, in retrospect, you have to sit back and re-experience things again. And so when we went into our neighborhood, our former neighborhood, we could see the real truth behind the discussions. And the way that the descriptions arrived in Nassau through official channels had nothing to do with the reality on the ground. I hope that makes sense. Sometimes it gets a little bit difficult to explain, because even though it's, 2 years later, the emotions still come flooding in.
Yes, yes, yes. It was an extremely traumatic experience, not only the storm experience, but the aftermath. I can only imagine.
And for the people who were there and who were telling the stories, they are the ones who are like devastated and have no channel to seek redress of any kind, or there is silence around the continued need for healing and recovery. So that,
it's extremely painful even 2 years later. So as an ethnographer now, you come in and you have to reflect not only the different narratives and accounts, but the differences in the narratives and accounts, right?
Yes, that's correct. And so depending on where you are spatially or located, where you are located, you will have a different experience. And that experience or those experiences put together and make up a truer account of what actually happened. So there are multiple voices in history, wherever that history occurs. And those multiple voices have to be equally weighted in order for a truer understanding of that historical moment. And if you lived in the mud, your experience would be harrowing. But if you lived half a mile in from the mud, your experience would be harrowing, except in a different way, where the roof of a second story building was taken off, or the entire second floor of the building was taken off because of the force. And at the same time, you have these floods pouring through your home. So you have to go up to the second floor. So there is this deep, deep, deep worry and anxiety that develops around where you can go. And that's one of the things that we pick up afterwards, is the trying to do justice to those voices, but also respect their privacy.
So you have to balance a couple of things in this kind of research.
Yes. And the privacy of the individual is key, as well as that individual's sanity and health. And there are times when, as is documented after Maria in Puerto Rico and after Irma and Maria in Barbuda, that people just want to tell their stories, and they will tell you their stories. And then when you ask them if you can use the story, sure. But they're not looking for anything else. And there are times when other people need professional engagement. So they actually need somebody to actively assist them get over the trauma. And there are others who will say, I want to tell this so that other people know that this has happened and they can do better. There can be things put in place so that this doesn't happen this way again. And that's incredibly important to the ethnographic experience and to the historical document.
It is important, it is. We are at the point of our first break. This is University Drive. We are speaking with Associate Professor of English, Dr. Ian Bethel-Bennett, who's completed research called Dorian on Making Space, Policy, Place, and Dislocation. We'll take a brief break and be back after this.
Chapter One Bookstore is your back-to-school headquarters. We are proud to serve the students, faculty, and staff of the University of the Bahamas and the community at large. We are the premier choice for the purchase of university textbooks and supplies and UB logo apparel, paraphernalia, and gifts. We also carry a wide variety of school supplies, learning aids, and leisure books. Visit our coffee center throughout the semester for all of your printing, copying, and binding needs. Chapter One Bookstore is located on the ground floor of the Michael Elden Complex. Shop with us on Monday through Friday between the hours of 8:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. Call us at 397-2650 or email us at chapter1@ub.edu.bs. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Chapter One Bookstore. See you soon.
Welcome back to University Drive. We are here with our guest, Dr. Ian Bethel-Bennett, a researcher who has looked at not only the impact of Hurricane Dorian, but its aftermath on Abaco and the fallout. And we are talking about his research. So Dr. Bethel-Bennett, let's talk about the community of Abaco, the history, its roots, and the way that the community is kind of stratified in present day as we continue our discussion about your research.
So Abaco, if everybody knows, is pretty much made up of loyalist settlers. So the loyalists were granted land by the Lord's proprietors, and those loyalist land grants have continued to have to be current in terms of ownership of land. So a lot of the loyalists that landed in the Bahamas were white. They were the ones granted land. When the black loyalists came, and Dr. Curry has done some very good documenting on this, the black loyalists did not receive those same grants. They did not receive the access that the white loyalists had received. So Abaco has a very interesting history because there are many settlements that continue to be loyalist dominated. And there are other settlements that are far more mixed. So Marsh Harbor is not a very attractive city. It is not particularly well planned. And we see this in Bahamian cities of newer ilk for the most part, just because they have been allowed to grow without a whole lot of oversight or structure. But other communities outside of Marsh Harbor are very tight-knit, and these tend to be older loyalist communities like Treasure Key or Elbow Key. And then you have the north of Abaco and the south of Abaco that tend to be much more where the population tends to be of African descent or darker skinned, and especially North Abaco has done fairly well under other government administrations. South Abaco has not done as well, but it has families in there that have done well. So the families who do well tend to bring the rest of the community with them for the most part, not always. So Sandy Point is in the south, then you have Crown Haven and those in the north, and then you have Elbow Key, Guanaki, and the barrier keys around the what would be considered the main Abaco Island. But Abaco is really made up of a bunch of keys that a lot of Bahamians don't understand because the keys seem unimportant. But to the Abaconians, these keys are, you know, very important. They are their territorial land or their traditional land. Hopetown is majority white for the most part, loyalist community, but it has become one of the focal points of second home ownership in the Bahamas. So a lot of traditional Hopetown families have moved out or sold their homes, or at least one of their homes, to second home owners from mostly the east coast of the United States. This has also happened on Guana Key. And Guana is an interesting case because of there was a very small local community, and that community has all but disappeared through the land deals that have occurred and through the desire to basically make the key more or less private for the interests of a particular business entity. So as Abaco has continued to develop, you have various communities that are white, brown, black, mixed, and then you have Haitians that tend to occupy a space outside of those Bahamian communities. Yet everybody understands that the Haitians are there. They have been there for a very long time, and there was a balance between the communities. So whenever we in New Providence think of illegals, it is not that these people are illegal. People are not illegal. The law makes them illegal. They may be there without documents, some of them, but many of them have documents, and they have lived there because they were rented space on that land. And so there are traditional areas of Abaco where, you know, segregation still seems to be somewhat functional, and there are still attitudes to that end. But in general, there is far more mixing of the generation of our kids who are in their teens and 20s now. And there's a lot of mixing there. But the older families refuse to mix, except in as much as there are extramarital affairs that carry on, as the entire Bahamas has known. So Abaco also has a deep connection to the United States and to those loyalist communities that would have fled the United States after the American War of Independence and during the Civil War. And I hope that gives a little bit of the context. So you have competing forces happening, but everybody wants the betterment of Abaco. And one of the challenges that most families are finding now is that they cannot afford to live where they have inherited land or a home, because the land value has increased so much through second home ownership that they are not at that level, but this is all they know. And they cannot sell because they can't afford to buy back on anywhere else. These discussions are completely absent from the local narrative. And they're also absent from the national narrative. And I think that really causes some misunderstanding of Bahamian identities, as Dr. Bethel and I discuss all the time. When I say Dr. Bethel, I mean Nicolette Bethel.
Nicolette Bethel. So yeah, that paints a very vivid picture, Dr. Bethel Bennett. And so your research was concentrated on what part or parts of Abaco?
I was that time in Marsh Harbor, but so Marsh Harbor is a small town, and then you get into Dundas Town, Murphyville, and Murphy Towns are not Murphyville. Murphyville is in New Providence. And what disappears again from the gaze or the awareness of people is how race constructs or defines the spatial relationship to those spaces. So Marsh Harbor, traditional Marsh Harbor, tended to be very white and segregated. And I went there first as I was in QC, and I was like, oh, wow, okay, this is interesting. And it has continued that way for the older families. And then you move towards the north, and the communities get darker, and then you get to Treasure Key and the community is once again lighter and almost all completely dominated by second home owners. So within Marsh Harbor, you have these nuances, and there's a lot of interesting development, because that was where much of the devastation had occurred. Of course, Treasure Key as well, but Marsh Harbor was really hard hit. And Marsh Harbor is no longer as cohesive as an area like Hopetown, where the community really pulled together and got things. I mean, they all worked for each other, for one another, and they built back their community much stronger as fast as they could. And you see that in other communities as well, but less so in and around Marsh Harbor, because a lot of those people were displaced. And those who are on the lower end of the economic spectrum had a much harder time returning, because they could not afford to rebuild in a way that, or build back quickly enough to move back quickly. So even when they were saying things like there is electricity, the electricity was pretty much off. Even, I think it was last week, this week, and the week before, there were more power outages each day than most people could count. So some days people were without power for 8 hours, or some days people were without power for 5 hours. But that compounds the situation that was Hurricane Dorian.
And all of it is a reflection of the different facets and aspects of our Bahamian-ness.
Correct.
Just the different realities that exist in Abaco. You have likened what survivors of Hurricane Dorian endured as the deep violence of a failed state. Why that particular characterization?
Okay. I think, if I'm not mistaken, this was also discussed at the Sustainable Grand Bahama Conference in Freeport in 2020, just before the pandemic erupted and shut us down. And one of the facts that emerged was that forces, I shall not point any fingers, did not do what was necessary for them to have done. There was no plan. So everything was helter-skelter. But in the helter-skelter, people used those moments who were meant to have been empowering others and assisting others to disempower and empower themselves and to enrich themselves. And that was a serious, serious blow. So there was a suspension of order, what Komarov and Komarov would call disorder. And that disorder became the new order. So there had to be private security forces brought in to protect some people's property and life. Other people alleged, and I have to use the word alleged, even though the narrative does not say alleged, that they were assaulted, that they were violated, and that they were harassed by the powers that were there to protect them. So the state kind of had this narrative that everything was good, there was no violence, yet those authorities were behaving in ways that were not conforming with that narrative. I hope that is not too indirect.
Okay, I hear what you're saying and what you're not saying, and what you're not pointing fingers, but you're talking about government structures, eh?
I am talking about government structures.
Yes. And further to that, you even wrote that a natural disaster becomes the moment of opportunity to unmake space and remake it in a more unjust way, but far more lucrative for those in power.
Yes.
That's a really dire injustice.
Yes. And unfortunately, when we look at accumulation by dispossession, a real Marxist theory that Karl Marx looks at as primitive accumulation, and then it comes to Rosa Luxemburg, and she writes Capital and Accumulation. And then David Harvey talks about accumulation by dispossession in terms of geography. But Harvey also points at the way that crises or a moment of crisis is managed and manipulated. So that, for example, the IMF will create, or the World Bank will create, a structural adjustment program for a country. After Dorian, that disaster capitalism kicked in very troubling ways. Mm-hmm. And there were what would be called land vultures elsewhere, but we don't refer to them as such, who were circling the internet and encouraging people to buy, or they wanted to buy land because they thought they could get it at a steal, which of course they could from some people, because the trauma was such that people simply thought, okay, I can just get out of here and move somewhere else and start again. And then there were others who took the time to remap and redesign the space to fit their images of paradise. So I will say that there are powers that be that wanted to remove particular communities from where they were, push them inland, and that way facilitate access to the coast. A piece of land on the coast is not the same, is not valued the same as a piece of land inland. So those are not equitable changes. A piece of land on the coast is worth far more to a particular group of people than a piece of land inland. So the people who are being moved, or who are potentially being moved, are people who are less able to afford to rebuild on the coast. But even if they build inland, they are not in a position to build back a resilient structure along the lines of second home owners. So we have communities that are now being displaced, dislocated, and dispossessed through the intended sale or remapping of those spaces. And just to use a very easy example, when you have an informal community develop and you move that informal community at a moment immediately after a crisis, that is also the use of that crisis to manipulate the situation, because the law was clear on why the injunctions were given. Whether I agree with an injunction or not is not the point. But the law tends to be clear on things even when it does not work in government's favor. And government tends to use particular forces to encourage others to understand that the law is not making sense, but the law is clear. What is nonsensical is the way that maybe the law is applied, or the way that the law is used to dispossess in very interesting in these situations.
And by injunction, you're talking about the injunction that applied to the Mud and Pigeon Pea in that matter.
Correct.
That controversial right. matter. What you're relaying is really some factors that work toward changing the socioeconomic characteristics of some parts of Abaco.
Yes. Yeah. And that has pretty much happened, and it will continue. So there are certain parts of Abaco that will no longer be easily accessible to Bahamians. And that is most Bahamians. Of course, there is a 5% who can still access that, or a 1%. But even within that, so the understanding of patrimony is that should be the commons. It should be used for the common good of the people. And this is where language tends to become very slippery is the best word. So immediately after Dorian, we know that there were many people who disappeared. We know that there were many people who died. What we cannot say with any certainty at this point is what those numbers are. But we know that far more people died than have been accounted for. Why we know that? Because the eyewitness reports document that, but the government has not accepted those eyewitness reports in any formal way. And then you have documentary photography that shows people who did not survive. And those documents have not been shared because, you know, they're very graphic. And then you have processes that immediately, in the immediate wake of Dorian, that people argue hid or removed evidence from the sites. So there are things are compounded, and the silences are compounded by what did and what didn't happen almost immediately after Dorian, when the tractors went in and started moving the mud. So once you move a space, you can no longer easily find the survivors or the people that did not survive. And it depends on how that space is moved as well, how successful your search will be afterwards. And I say that to say in a very advised manner that damage would have been done to evidence that was entombed in some of the rubble. And, you know, that there at this point, it is almost too late to undo that damage.
It is also very tragic, so very tragic. We are speaking of the research conducted by Dr. Ian Bethel Bennett, Associate Professor at University of the Bahamas, on the community of Abaco in the aftermath of Hurricane Dorian. We'll take this next break, but stay tuned. We'll be back after this.
To protect yourself and others from COVID-19, stay home as much as possible and avoid close contact with others. Wear a mask that covers your nose and mouth when you leave home. Wash your hands with soap and water for at least 20 seconds, or use alcohol-based hand sanitizer. Practice social distancing. If you must leave home, stay at least 6 feet away from other people and disinfect items you must touch. Limit in-person contact as much as possible. To prevent the spread of COVID-19 if you're sick, avoid public transportation, ride sharing, or taxis. Stay home if you're sick, except to get medical care. Remember to call ahead first. Separate yourself from other people and pets in your home. Everyone is at risk of getting COVID-19. Older adults and people of any age who have serious underlying medical conditions may be at higher risk for more severe illness. This message is brought to you by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and University of the Bahamas.
Back we are here on University Drive. We're talking with Dr. Ian Bethel Bennett, who conducted research in the aftermath of Hurricane Dorian and has been able to uncover some fascinating things. We have been talking about the injustices that can happen, the remaking of space, and your research study was published recently in the International Journal of Bahamian Studies, which is the University of the Bahamas research journal. What I want to ask you, though, is what are the salient conclusions of your study, and how do we apply the information that you've been able to amass in a way that would be beneficial to us, particularly when disaster strikes or as we prepare for the inevitable?
And I like how you say prepare for the inevitable, because it is inevitable. There is climate change is real. There is sea level rise. Under the former administration, this was not discussed, and that seems to be changing so far under this administration. If we look at the prime minister of Barbados, she has been very adamant that the developed world or the first world, the major countries, have to step up and take responsibility for their actions that are causing these crises to continue and to deepen. When I taught at the University of Puerto Rico, what I found refreshing was that there was a constant move between the university and the community. I'm not saying that it was always smooth. I'm saying that it existed, so that there was a group from the law school who set up a free clinic on fideicomiso for a community in San Juan. And that community was at the risk of being erased by then mayor of San Juan, who thought, because he could not simply move them, he would give each family a deed to their property that had until then been deemed uninhabitable. So by giving them a deed, he was commodifying their property, and he could then offer them a particular amount of money that they would have thought to be huge, and that way buy them out of the community. So separate the community by commodifying it, that which is a privatization move. And through separating the community, weakening the spirit, and then basically getting inroads into the community and moving the others out. That was not successful for the most part. And when we see those signals coming up, we understand that this is not unique to that time and place or that space and place. And we have similar things. So one of the things we have to do is create a plan that can be executed, not a plan that sits up in the sky somewhere. And there is currently no plan to move people around. There is a law that for the recovery or the restructuring of the Bahamas, but that law is very punitive, and it is dangerous in its ambiguities, and it basically goes against the Constitution, which is interesting because as far as I know, no one has officially challenged the lack of constitutionality of that particular law. And the law allows people to be moved from their home if it is seen that they are in danger. what is absent from the law is when those people are moved from their home, when will they be returned? How will they be returned? How will they be cared for in the process or in the interim? And if they are taken somewhere, where are they taken and how will they get back? All of this is silent, so that there is no step-by-step policy. That step-by-step policy is necessary and essential to the proper running of a country. Also, when you move people, you are displacing them and you are dislocating their entire familial structure. So you have now taken them out of their orbit and they have to rely on someone else to work with them in order for them to survive. None of that is considered in our plan for mitigation after the fact. There is still no adaptation. We think about adaptation in terms of improving the building codes. If there are two building inspectors, that would be a great many. And those building inspectors have a hard press to get to every point on New Providence to inspect the building. So it's very hard for them to get to other places as well. And I'm not saying that we just let people build willy-nilly. There has to be a cultural awareness in policy that does not destroy the national culture or the national cultures. So culture in the Bahamas is incredibly spatially located. And if you build a house on Abaco, for the most part, it is very difficult to afford to build the structure that you would build on New Providence in Abaco because everything comes in from somewhere else. So none of these factors seem to be brought together in any way that makes it equitable or practicable for people to follow these so-called codes and policies. The other part of that is the regulation. If we are to regulate something, there has to be a clear regulatory body that does not shift and change with the wind. And that is one other challenge that we understand. If we are regulating the movement of material from island to island, that will make material far more expensive. How are we going to mitigate with this cost on the islands? But there seems to be no sight of that complication.
What I also found fascinating was a perspective you expressed on the impact of the Commercial Enterprises Act within the whole context of unmaking spaces of community and the Disaster Preparedness and Response Act.
So one of the purposes behind the first act you mentioned was to create industry in the country, to promote the development of industry. The act is meant to encourage tech to come in and set up on Grand Bahama. The act is also meant to encourage fishermen or fishers to come in and develop the fishing industry. But these acts, while they may appear innocuous, actually encourage foreign direct investment over encouraging Bahamian investors to invest in those companies, because there are a number of considerations that are either absent or too onerous for many Bahamians. And we are looking at the ways in which international companies can come in, land, and use their $250,000 basic fee to bring in other employees who then displace local or Bahamian workers. And so the higher hierarchical structure of labor within the post-colony continues. And that's a reality, and it continues to be a challenge. And we saw that after Dorian, when the Mexican workers were brought in from Mexico with all these justifications as to how they could be employed and why they were needed, and that they were healthy, yet still there were number of outbreaks that could be linked back to them. These legal obligations have to be considered in a much more culturally nuanced way. And the way that we have looked up to now is that this law applies in this context as it would apply anywhere else. And that's not necessarily a positive thing for Bahamian infrastructure. So what we're developing is a two-pronged development process where you have international foreign direct investment and you have local development that is being swamped by the ability of foreign direct investment to invest huge amounts of money into large swaths of land or swathes of land in where the local developer has to take it much more slowly and invest little by little in the development of that space. So those acts do not necessarily facilitate a local approach to development, even though that's what they claim to do. And then you have acts that come after the Commercial Enterprises Act that are amended in complete opposition to what the Commercial Enterprises Act claims to be doing. So there is this, I would call it a free-for-all in the way that the law seems to be going, or in the direction that the law seems to be going and the ways that it's getting there.
As a researcher who's completed this kind of research, right? What's next? How is this information to be used in a way that's beneficial for us?
And that is one of the challenges that we face, because how do you get information out there? And publishing a journal is good, but it can only go so far. It has to be much more multi-layered. And when I say that, I mean, there have to be different layers to getting the information out there, because most people are not going to read. There has to be much more community involvement in understanding what hurricane preparedness looks like, not just in telling people they need to boil water or put up shutters. What does that look like? How can we make this a reality in this community? And there are communities in the Bahamas that simply cannot survive if that magnitude storm comes again. So they either have to be displaced temporarily, and there has to be a plan in place to occupy that. So this is the thing. If you live a foot above the water, you are not going to survive a Dorian, or you're not going to survive a Katrina. You're not going to survive a Joaquin if you are on the coast, say South Beach, because the level of flooding that will come through, if nothing else, will take the people who cannot swim out to sea. So it's not just about having a hurricane plan, it's about also making people aware of what they need to do, making them agents in their own lives. So learn to swim, get an axe. You may need to hack your roof open, or understand that you can leave your house. The house can go away, but at least you will survive. And that to some people is a foreign concept, because we have invested so much in our homes that, Jesus, Mary and Joseph, if I leave this house, I have nothing. And that alone is a national trauma, because most people understand that they can't build back. So there has to be much more robust community awareness. And that, unfortunately, has to be facilitated through different government agencies, and government agencies have to speak to each other.
We have been talking with Associate Professor of English at University of the Bahamas, who's completed research on the Hurricane Dorian's impact on Abaco, with particular emphasis and focus on space and policy and place and dislocation. He's been our special guest today. Thank you so much, Dr. Bethel Bennett, for joining us. You have an open invitation to come back and join us again.
Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that. And I don't know if the research is ever complete, because each facet of this is going to be different. And the further away we get from Dorian, the more we will understand what went wrong and what needs to change.
So the work will continue.
Yes, the work definitely continues.
As it should. Thank you so much for being here. With that, we bring our show to a close. This has been University Drive. Remember to stay connected with news and updates and views about University of the Bahamas. Follow us on social media and also at www.ub.edu.bs. You can actually read the full volume of the International Journal of Bahamian Studies on the university's website. Go to our website, click on research, and just click on International Journal of Bahamian Studies. I've been your host, Tamika Lundy. Join us again next time for University Drive.
University Drive is a production of the Office of University Relations and the Communications and Creative Arts Academic Unit at University of the Bahamas. All rights reserved.